My name is Deanne Lagerquist. When I'm not at Holden Village, I teach in the religion department of St. Olaf College in Northfield, Minnesota. And I am here for the summer along with my husband, Rick Dunning, who is the curator of the Portal Museum. If you haven't been there, you go across the bridge and up the hill. And my 14-month-old son, Thomas, who you probably have seen walking around as quickly as he can. This is our fourth full summer at Holden Village, so I'm starting to feel like quite a fixture here. And what I'm going to talk with you about today is something that I spent a lot of time thinking about, a lot of time working with students on this topic, namely women and Christianity. In fact, I'm getting ready to do a course next January. St. Olaf clings to the old 414 calendar, where in January we have a term in which students have only one course. I'm going to teach a course in that term next year that's called Feminist Christianity and Oxymoron? And so today, instead of launching right into my historical, my romp through history, I want to just talk a little bit about definitions, about what is feminism and what is Christianity and how those two might be related. And then we'll look at some historical material as a way of feeding our understanding of the relationship between these two things. Feminism is a word that many people are afraid of, I think. If you say the F word, people may think you're avoiding a four-letter swear word, or in the right circles, they may think, sort of like the L word was liberal in 4 years ago, that if you say the F word, maybe you're talking about feminism. I find that 18-year-old students tend to think that it's something scary, something sort of dramatic, and that they don't want to be associated with it. And yet, I would say, it would be my assertion, that feminism covers a huge range of viewpoints, but that all those viewpoints coalesce around one negative assertion. This is the negative assertion. Women are no less important than men. Okay, now you can imagine there are many variations on that general negative statement, and those variations each have their own origin and their own agenda. So, for example, a variation of women are no less important than men is women are more important than men, or women are better than men, or, and these would come out of the romantic tradition, for example, in which women are associated with nature and nature is elevated as something better than civilization. Or we have what is, I think, the mainstream of feminism in the United States, which comes out of Anglo-American liberal political philosophy, which is civil rights. Women are no less important than men because women and men have the same rights, the equal rights. My own variation, which I think has its roots in Christianity, would be women are no less important than men because women and men are equally bad. Okay, that we have equal original sin, we equally stand in need of God's grace. Now, you can imagine that's a real different beginning point than the first two that I mentioned. And it would suggest then, when we come to the part of relationship, a different relationship between feminism and Christianity than the other two would. Okay, so what is Christianity? Maybe we also think that we know what that is. But it seems to me that in our society today, the word Christianity, especially insofar as it is associated with the church, is equally misunderstood and equally scary to many people as feminism is. Most generally, I suppose we could say that Christianity is that way of life which centers on the assertion that Jesus is the Christ who offers some kind of answer to human problems. Okay, and in theological terms, we talk about sin and salvation and so forth. there are as many variations of that as there are variations of feminism. So that you know what you see on television on Sunday morning with the televangelist, which is this sort of decision-based theology with the result of health and prosperity, is very different than some other kinds of Christianity that emphasize original sin, for example, or that give meaning in times of suffering and so forth. Some Christianity emphasizes the gifts of the Holy Spirit as being central. Others will emphasize stability and the authority of the church. Well, what relationship can there be between these two clusters of things that I have indicated can go under the names feminism and Christianity? Let me suggest three, which I've given clever titles to, all starting with the letter A. Okay, the first is that they're apathetic, that they have nothing to do with each other at all. And certainly we can find people who would take that position, both from the side of feminism and from the side of Christianity. There are feminists who say, Christianity, yuck, I want nothing to do with it, it has nothing to do with me, I don't have to worry about it at all. Just ignore it, it's a dying religion, it's best just ignored. There are bigger problems to take care of. Also, there are some Christians who think that feminism and perhaps, as a corollary, women aren't very important and don't need to be taken into account. I'm always astonished when I find myself in a congregation that seems to be so apathetic to the concerns that feminists have raised in the last two decades that I feel like I've been transported back to 1947. I'm just like, of course, I'm especially shocked when I go into one of those where I happen to know the pastor for some reason. But those are there. A second kind of relationship would be adversarial or antithetical, where it's not just, I don't care, it doesn't matter, but rather there are some feminists who think that Christianity is the arch villain, that Christianity could be characterized as saying not women are no less important than men, but quite the opposite. Women are not as important as men. Women are something less than men. And I think we have to admit candidly and upfront that there are Christians who have and do say that. So that this reaction from the side of feminism is not without grounds. From the Christian side, there are Christians, among them people with whom I am in close professional relationship, who would answer the question, feminist Christianity an oxymoron? Yes, indeed, it is an oxymoron. Feminism is out to destroy Christianity. And in an odd way, those people and the feminists who have this position agree with each other. Okay, they agree that their fundamental assertions are contradictory and should have, and therefore are dangerous to each other. Now, the third position obviously has to be some kind of a compromise, right? From they have nothing to do with each other and they're the opposite of each other. And the compromise I would characterize as affirming and adjusting. That is to say that there's some sort of affinity between these two that means they can affirm each other, but they also require adjustment. That feminism that has as its basis Christianity will be somewhat different than feminism that has as its basis political liberalism. And that Christianity, which pays attention to its affinities with feminism, will be different from the kind of Christianity that you might hear about in something like Basic Youth Conflicts, if any of you are familiar with that. It's a clear chain of command. The father of the family has authority over the mother of the family, who has authority over the children in the family. I don't know, not having gone to it myself, I don't know if they talk about the pets. But, you know, you sort of get that, the great chain of being on a domestic scale. Okay, so there are at least these three possible relationships, apathetic, adversarial, and affirming and adjusting. All are represented today, and I expect that if we if we had more than an hour, we could find all of those positions represented in the 2,000 years of Christianity as well. Although the term feminism is a neologism, it's a new word that wasn't used more than, 200 years ago, probably at the very latest. It's important that we look backwards, because Christianity is a religion which takes seriously that God's action in human events is a way that we come to know about God. Both those events that are recorded in the Bible and those events that have happened since the Bible. Okay, so I think it's incumbent on us as we try to figure out what is the relationship between feminism and Christianity, that we look at how this has been working in the past. Okay, what we will find. I'd like to give you four little hints about the things that we could find. We won't get all of this in our short tour, but we will find that there are women who have received from Christianity meaning and purpose. There are women whose lives have been abundantly enriched by Christianity, and whose lives that haven't always been abundant and rich have been given meaning because of the teachings of Christianity. We will find that there are women who have been active in the work of the gospel. So not only have they received meaning and purpose, but they have done things that have advanced Christianity in some way. Thirdly, as I've already suggested, we would find a range of assertions about women, or about woman, femaleness, about women's activity. We'll find things like women are evil. Right? We'll find the opposite, find a wide range. So it's not that looking back in history tells us, oh, precisely this is it. Here's the easy answer. We just memorize the answer. We will also find that there are several views about the significance of gender relative to the divine. And that's not something I'm going to take up very much today. But if one were to look at that, we discover that when we talk about women in the church, we need to pay attention not just to women on the ground, flesh and blood women, but also how femaleness gets used symbolically, and how femaleness and maleness, or femininity and masculinity, are attached somehow to divinity, or are not allowed to be attached to that. Okay, now what we're going to do in the next 45 minutes is really more than 2,000 years, because I wanted to start with the Old Testament. I guess that's as far as it goes. It's fine. So I think of this as an aerial view, like you're flying over the top. A couple points I'll suggest books that you might want to take a look at. When we talk about the Bible, very recently has come out, and I did notice that there's at least one copy of this in the bookstore, the Women's Bible Commentary, a nice one-volume commentary that looks at each book of the Bible with particular concerns relative to women in mind. And of course, when we start at the beginning, one of the first women who comes to mind is Eve, the mother of us all, perhaps. And we would want to talk about the way the story in Genesis 2 and 3 has been used throughout our tradition. It's been used as a way to explain the origin of the human race. It's also been used as a way to explain sexual difference. Why are there men and why are there women? Why are there two kinds of human beings? It's also been used as an explanation for the origin of sin. Okay? And if you have a sort of feminism that begins with the assertion, women are no less important than men because women are and men are equally bad, then you get to cope with this story, which has often been interpreted to say, well, actually, women are less important than men, or at least less good, because after all, Eve is the one who ate the apple first. Not everyone has understood that the story in quite that way. Some, like Phyllis Tribble, have looked at the story and said, well, why is it that the serpent went to Eve first? Maybe she was more interesting to talk to. It wasn't that she was dumb, but if he was going to have a theological discussion, of course, he'd go to the person who was likely to have one, right? Very recently, a former colleague of mine has written a fascinating paper looking at the Hebrew puns in this, in the creation account. And it, although I don't read Hebrew, I trust Julianne Bush to the utmost. And she, as she plays with the puns in there, it seems to me that her reading is a true one, that the story isn't so much about a dichotomy as it is about the intertwining of these two people and these people and God. And I, as I was preparing, I thought, gee, I wish I'd brought that along so I could refresh my memory on precisely how Julie has done that. The story is not used only by Christians. It gets used in a lot of ways. And I have just a couple contemporary examples for your amusement. Like Newsweek used Adam and Eve in this cover story about man's origins. I think it's Adidas. Here they're emphasizing the difference between men and women. The story gets used lots and lots of different ways. So even if you want to say that feminism and Christianity are apathetic to each other, we do find that some of the legacy of Christianity continues to influence our society in some very profound, popular ways. Okay, now, quickly, through the rest of the Old Testament. This is Lot's wife. And the three slides that I have to talk about the Old Testament probably aren't the best ones. They're the ones that I have. I don't know that I would have picked Lot's wife. But as it seems to me when we look in the Old Testament, we would want to look at legal codes, which we're not going to do today. We'd want to talk about the symbolic use of femaleness, like in the wisdom literature, the city of Jerusalem, the way the people of Israel are sometimes characterized as the bride of Yahweh. When you read the book of Hosea, it's very clear that the human experience of romantic love and marriage is being used to help these people understand their relationship with God. Okay, we're not going to do either of those. We're going to look more at the storyline. Many of the women in this storyline don't have names, and Lot's wife is one of them. She's a disobedient woman, and she's really used as a type here to teach a story about to teach a lesson about being disobedient, which is why she turns into salt. Hagar is a foreign woman, which is a type that appears often in the Old Testament, often as a dangerous woman. She's foreign, and people might be led away from Yahweh by a foreign woman. But she's also in an interesting relationship with Sarah, a woman who was barren and to whom Yahweh gives fertility. Another important type in the Old Testament. The other thing I think is important to point out about Hagar is that she talks to God. And if you go back and read the two accounts of Hagar in Genesis, it's very interesting how she has this conversation with God. And God makes a promise to her about Ishmael and how Ishmael's family will grow, sort of parallel to what goes on with Abraham and Sarah. And then Ruth and Naomi. Interestingly, Ruth is the descendant of Lot's daughters who trick their father into having sexual intercourse with them so that they will be able to bear children and he can have descendants. And that's what the Old Testament tells us is the origin of the Moabites. Ruth is a Moabite woman, a foreign woman who's brought in to the Israelite people through her marriage to an Israelite. She also is a wonderful example of loyalty and friendship with her mother-in-law, Naomi. She ends up being the grandmother of King David. And some people think that this book of Ruth is in there to as a sort of balance to some of the legal codes about keeping foreign women out. Okay? So here's the law and here's how it works. Okay, interesting thing going on there. I think that's an important thing to keep in mind as you look at the history of women in Christianity, that sometimes the prescription and how things really work don't match. Okay, then zipping along to the New Testament, somewhere between my table and here, I lost my Madonna slide. I'm sorry. Obviously, we need to start with the Madonna. The Madonna, or Mary, the mother of Jesus, is sometimes paired with Eve as a new Eve, even as Jesus is a new Adam. Okay, so that we get this balance. But Mary also becomes part of a pair of the two options available to women, right? You can be a good girl, virgin, or a bad girl, whore. And of course, the singer with the name Madonna just plays with that dichotomy all the time, you know, of trying to have the name and act differently and in very peculiar ways. Mary, the mother of Jesus, has been held up to women as an example of what they should be as Christians, and yet she embodies an impossibility to be both this pure virgin and a mother. I think if we read the Gospels more carefully, one of the most fascinating critiques of that is Jesus' own critique of it when someone from the crowd says to him, "Blessed is the womb that gave you birth and the breast that gave you suck." Do you remember what his response is? No. Blessed is the one who knows God's will and does it. Okay. There are many other Marys in Jesus' life. This icon of Mary and Martha, of course, points to one of those Marys and another set of options. Which have been used in our tradition not just for women, but for the whole of Christianity. What are the options? You can be in the kitchen, active, service, like Martha, or you can be sitting at the feet of Jesus, studying, like Mary. And that this story about Mary and Martha says that Mary has taken the better part. And yet often women have been told that Martha is the one they should emulate, okay, that Mary is for men and Martha is for women. I think we should be very careful about this because if you read the other story about Martha, she's certainly not staying in the kitchen fixing up the hors d'oeuvres. She's marching out to meet Jesus and she says to him, "If you had come a little sooner, my brother wouldn't be dead. So where have you been?" And then she makes a confession about, "But I know that you can do all things." So there we see Martha not only as a servant, but as a remarkable theologian and as a woman who's really has taking Jesus at his word and calling him into account for it. I think of it, a friend of mine tells about Luther's response to one, I can't remember now which story it is, but how he says, if God changes his promises, I would cling to those promises and throw them back in God's face and say, "You promised me these things." And I always think of that when I read about Martha. Now, another Mary, of course, is Mary Magdalene. And I suppose we could pair her with the Blessed Virgin because we think of Mary Magdalene as being this harlot, right? Who Jesus somehow converted. Actually, we don't know very much about Mary Magdalene at all. Seven demons were thrown out, were cast out of her. We don't know what these demons were. I always think about when I was about 14, I had those underwear that had every day written on them, you know, seven pair. And I'm like, well, maybe the demons are for one for every day. Mostly we don't know very much about Mary Magdalene at all. And as is frequently the case when we don't know very much about someone, lots of legends get attached. Mary of Bethany is named in some of the Gospels, in one of the Gospels, and not the other. She's the one who anoints Jesus. She's likely the sister of Martha. And what she's doing there is also making a confession about who Jesus is. Anointing is for kings and for dead people and for priests. Okay, those are the three kinds of people who were anointed in that society. And so when Mary does that with the, you know, the ointment, the expensive ointment, and Jesus says, don't be mad to the host, don't be mad at her for doing this. You didn't even give me water to wash my feet, and this woman has anointed me, she's washing my feet with her hair. In a way, she's predicting who Jesus really is, that he's the priest, that he's a king, and that he will die. There are many, many other women with whom Jesus had contact, and there's been a lot of work done in recent years about Jesus' relationship with women and how it was unlike what we might have expected him to have, what that suggests about the gospel and the gospel's meaning for our understanding of men and women. Some of those women, of course, came to the tomb, and there they found it empty. They were the first witnesses to the resurrection, that thing which is central to Christianity. When we say in that, you know, when I define Christianity, that it is this religion that has as its core the assertion that Jesus has the answers for the world's problems. This is where we turn, to the cross and to the tomb. And here the women are the first there. Among them was probably Mary Magdalene. And here you see a very old representation of Mary Magdalene preaching, which is an apostolic task. When we come closer to the present day, I'll say that one of the issues has always been women's active leadership. Are women allowed to have the office of preaching? And one of the arguments that is used to this day in Roman Catholicism against women having the office of the priest is that Jesus called only male disciples or only male apostles. One of the criteria for being an apostle was that you had been with Jesus. Another was that you had seen the risen Lord. The Apostle Paul did not have the first. He had only the second. Mary Magdalene has both. And I sometimes wonder if the other apostles knew that when they chose Matthias to fill Judas's place. The Gnostic Gospels suggest to me that maybe they did. The Gnostic Gospels, some Gospels that aren't in our New Testament, have a real underlying tension between Mary Magdalene and Peter. It's real clear in those Gospels that Mary Magdalene and Peter did not get along. And so maybe they knew that Mary Magdalene was an apostle, but they weren't willing yet to give her the office. It's speculation, right? It's speculation. A lot of history is imagination, how we put the pieces together, because we're always missing pieces. Okay, as sort of a transition, here is a representation of the Madonna, but as the church. One of the ways femaleness gets used symbolically in Christianity is that we personify the church as a woman, sometimes as Mary, the mother of Jesus, sometimes just as a mother. Cyprian, who was a bishop in North Africa in about 250, said that unless you have the church as your mother, you cannot have God as your father. And he obviously here he's using those parental images in a symbolic way to balance each other. But he's also saying something about how you come to know God, that you come to know God through the church. You need both. We have that hymn, "The church's one foundation is Jesus Christ, her Lord," on and on. He's came, from heaven he came and sought her to be his holy bride. Then the church is represented not as mother, but rather as bride. Sort of a continuation of that thing in Hosea. And later that image will be transferred from the whole church to individuals, so that in the mystical tradition, often the believer, whether male or female, is characterized or understood to be the bride of Christ. And that relationship, very passionate relationship, is one to help us understand our relationship with God. Okay. Now, in the last 25 years, lots and lots of work has been done on women in Christianity. There is a book which is now 5 or 6 years old called Her Story by Barbara McAfee, which I think is accessible and a good introduction if you're interested. In the early church, we know that women were active leaders. This is Thecla. Name is used, it's attached to other women who will have a leadership role in the church, particularly sort of prophetic roles. When we look in Paul's writings, we can also identify some individual women who gave leadership in the church in various ways. But as the years passed, one of the ideals of Christianity was a sort of detachment from this world, which at its most extreme resulted in martyrdom. This is a certificate someone could buy to say that they'd done the thing that the empire asked you to do so that you wouldn't be executed. But many women, as well as many men, didn't buy them, and they ended up being martyrs. Martyrdom is an equal opportunity employer. And we have several examples of named martyrs. Perhaps one of the most interesting one is Perpetua, who was from the same area that Cyprian was in North Africa, who wrote, we have from her hand, an account of her imprisonment. A very fascinating thing about how she understood herself as a Christian, where her authority came from, and so forth. This is Paula, her daughter, and Saint Jerome. Saint Jerome is the one who translated the Bible into Latin, the Vulgate edition. Paula was his pupil and colleague. I put these up here to point out that as we move from the very early church into the 300s and 400s, women are losing some of the active roles that they had had. As the office of priest solidifies, women are denied access to it for a variety of reasons. But as martyrdom gives way to monasticism, many women find in monasticism an opportunity to pursue holiness. Women like Paula were noble Roman women. They had money. Jerome didn't. And when they go to the Holy Land and there found a double monastery, it's Paula's money, of course, on which this is based, and to some degree Jerome's reputation. We have no writings from Paula, but we do have some letters Jerome wrote both to her and to her daughter, and in those he notes that he wishes they would stop studying so much because they keep him up all the night trying to find out the answers to their questions. Which suggests to me that they were pretty good scholars. Okay. Then this woman is a member of the imperial house. I have her up there to indicate that women in positions of some nobility were patrons of Christianity. And as Orthodox Christian theology was being worked out, as the doctrines were being refined, the patronage of various imperial officials was important. And among those imperial officials, there were women. We would want to admit that often they were on the side that did not become orthodoxy, but nonetheless, they were there. Christianity spreads from its Mediterranean focus into up north into Europe. This is supposedly the desk that belonged to a princess named Ragunda. I put it there in order that I can say an interesting phenomenon in the spread of Christianity into Europe, into the Germanic tribal cultures, is the role of the exchange of women in marriage. Can really trace Christianity's movement north by looking at the the way that tribes use women to solidify alliances, and that as Christian princesses marry, they seem to bring Christianity with them. So you can see that moving north. Monasticism will continue to be very important for women's participation in Christianity. Here you see an abbess. And do you see what she has in her hand? A staff. Now, of course, we all know from Sunday school a staff is something that a shepherd uses. If those of you who are Lutherans, if you read the Lutheran, you may have read lots of controversy in the last few years about a staff called a crozier and bishops, right? Because some people think bishops should have them and other people think they shouldn't, and back and forth and around and so forth. But the reason I bring that up is that the crozier is a symbol of the bishop's office. Who has this? My goodness, what's going on here? Well, it seems as though in some medieval monastic houses for women, the abbess functioned in many ways like a bishop. And we know that in the 600s, at the Synod of Whitby, a very important synod that decided whether the English church would align itself with Ireland or with Rome, the abbess of Whitby, Hilda, voted. Again, she voted on the losing side, but she voted, right? Something that didn't happen at Vatican II. There were no abbesses who were voting there. Monasticism also provided for women access to education. This is so dark. Women took part in worship and composed music to be used in worship. It also was a place where, of course, women were doing work. The sisters often were involved in textiles, just like women who weren't in a monastery would have been doing. The monastery is the place where the mystical tradition is rooted. Mystical tradition I would describe as a parallel tradition to the scholastic theological tradition. It isn't only a women's tradition, but women seem to have been particularly involved in it. This is Hildegard of Bingen, and I know some of you may have heard of her. I know there's a book of hers sitting over on the bookstore table. Women also participated in Christianity as patrons. And I use that word in two senses. Both patrons as those who go to a thing, right? They make use of it and they support it. And this is Matilda of Canossa, a noblewoman who had a castle where a very important encounter between a pope and an emperor took place. But I have her up there then as a sort of stand for the way noblewomen were patrons of the church, users of it, and supporters of it. Also, there were some, Catherine of Siena was not a monastic. She was a tertiary, third order Dominican. She was a reformer. When the papacy was moved to Avignon in southern France, Catherine was one of those who persuaded the Pope to move back to Rome. She was very involved in the politics of the church as well as in mystical theology. What about lay women who weren't noble? Well, it's harder to find out about them, of course, but the various things that the church had to offer were available to them, like going on a pilgrimage, knowing the stories of the saints, healings, going to the Eucharist, etc. One of the most famous medieval women pilgrims is Marjorie Kemp. Here you see a death mask of hers. Then we'll just jump right ahead to the Reformation. If you're getting a little motion sickness, please just breathe deeply. Okay, this is Catherine von Bora. Perhaps comes at least to Lutheran's mind right away when we think of women in the Reformation. Well, there was Katie Luther. And she ran a big household, and she was mistress of the pig farm and a good brewer, and she kept a trout pond, and all those students who stayed at her house. That's not the whole extent of the Reformation for women. We could restate a very famous essay with the title, Was There a Renaissance for Women? I think we can also ask legitimately, was there a Reformation for women? In some ways, women lost in the Reformation in Christianity. They lost, among Protestants, the monastic option. But what they gained in Protestantism included the spiritualization of the home, that women were no longer required to make a choice between family life and a spiritual ideal, nor were men required to make that choice anymore. I think that vocation, the notion that any calling, that any occupation can be honorable and of service to God, something that comes out of the Protestant Reformation, has been very important for women. Among Roman Catholics, we continue to have women as patrons. This is Isabella, who we think of always with Columbus. She was also a patron of reform of Spanish Roman Catholicism, as was Teresa of Avila. And sometime as the Roman Catholic Reformation went on, 100 years, 150 years after the beginnings of the Protestant Reformation, we began to have some possibilities of Catholic women in orders having an active apostolate, that is, that they can go out of the enclosure. And these are the Ladies of Charity, founded by St. Vincent de Paul. Okay. Among Protestants, three other things about Protestant women in the Reformation. The revival of martyrdom among the radicals, of course, gave women an opportunity to give that witness. And in some ways, because some radicals, the Anabaptists, rejected infant baptism, it put them at some risk, not only directly, but indirectly, because midwives could report them if they didn't baptize their children. And so if you were afraid that the midwife would report you, it might mean that you would have to go through childbirth without the assistance of a midwife. Other radical Protestants, like the Quakers, gave women a public role. Because of the Quaker understanding that the Spirit of God, the light of God, is in all of us, Quakers allowed women to preach. Not all radical reforming groups did that, but those that relied especially on the Spirit of God did. And there continued to be patrons. This is Marguerite of Navarre, who was a patron of some of the Calvinist reformers and was herself something of a theologian, although not in a traditional theological format. A classmate of mine is working on Marguerite's writings, which are more of a literary form than a theological form, but she thinks there's a great deal of theological content there. Okay, now, for the modern era, we jump to the United States. I'm conflating the two. That's what happens when you're going from a very high altitude. And here we start with a colonial figure. This is Mary Dyer. She was a Quaker. She was executed on Boston Common, you could say a martyr to religious liberty. Those who founded those original colonies were interested in a certain kind of religious liberty. It was religious liberty for themselves, not for Quakers and other dissenters. So Mary Dyer was executed there, and there is a statue of Mary Dyer. It is not on Boston Common. You have to look for it. And maybe you could say better where it is, Linda, but we finally found it after some looking, and by that time I didn't know where I was anymore, so I can't tell you where it is. The Puritan view, for some reason I have a picture of a Puritan woman, but I do have this pilgrim from Pilgrim Rock, so here we go. The Puritan view of women is a very interesting one because they understood the relationship of the believer to God as being one of obedience, of submission, of many things that they associated with femaleness. They thought that women had a particular kind of religiosity. At least one Puritan divine also allowed that because of the danger of childbirth, women were more often close to death and consequently more likely to be religious than men. This notion that somehow femaleness and religiosity are connected led to the view in the 18th and 19th century that women have a particular sphere, or that women have their compass, really you should say. Women have their hemisphere, because it assumes a sort of complementarity, that women have their things and men have their things. In the 19th century, at least one scholar has identified what she calls the cult of true womanhood, that the ideal woman was submissive, pure, domestic, and pious. Shakers used that same notion of complementarity between femaleness and maleness in a very interesting way that required everything to be balanced. Many of you who have visited a Shaker village have noted that all the buildings have two doors, a door for men and a door for women. All of their religious exercises would be like this, with men and women balanced. The leadership, similarly, the elders and the elder, right? They're founded by Mother Ann Lee, who was understood by them to be the female incarnation of Christ, who balanced the male incarnation of Christ in Jesus. I visited one of the Shaker villages in New England, which is now a museum, and there I saw a wonderful picture of the Shaker Sisters Saxophone Sextet. Say that fast. Because in the later years of the Shakers, there weren't as many men who were attracted to the group, and so they couldn't do these marches anymore because they didn't have the balance. So then they found this other kind of worship. Sojourner Truth, a former slave and abolitionist, gave a very important and famous speech in the 19th century in which he called this cult of true womanhood into question. It's sometimes known as the Ain't I a Woman speech, in which she talked about her life as a slave, bearing many children, seeing them sold into slavery, never being helped across a puddle, never being helped into a carriage, and ain't I a woman too? She ends by saying something about Jesus and how she didn't see how a man had anything to do with Jesus. It was God and a woman who brought Jesus into the world. There was no man that had anything to do with it. Others of her time, this is Lucretia Mott and her husband James, one of my personal heroines, a Quaker preacher who was an abolitionist, an educational advocate, an advocate of women's rights, a famous baker of pies, mother of many children, if not the original, certainly one of the first superwomen. And as she gets older, you can see the toll that it took on her. She doesn't look great here, but you should see her later in life. She and her colleagues had an interesting way, some of them, of moving from this notion that women are particularly religious and should have the home into the reform of society, both through the American Abolitionist Society and the Women's Christian Temperance Union, that if women are responsible for the home, then they begin to expand their understanding of home beyond the walls of the house, so that all of society is included in the home, and that women's values, women's morality, would make a better world. Okay, and in the arguments about women getting the vote, some used that argument that if women would be able to vote, politics would be cleaned up in no time and we'd have all these good laws, right? Well, it didn't turn out exactly that way, but that was the argument. Another thing that women have been very involved in since the early 1800s has been foreign missions. And I'm going to show you three ways that women were involved. This is Anne Hasseltine Judson. She was the wife of one of the first missionaries who was sent from the United States. They started out from from New England as Congregationalists, and by the time they got to India, they were Baptists. Anne Haseltine was a sort of icon of 19th century America. Everyone knew her. And she represented a sort of ideal of Christian womanhood. She'd gone off. She ended up in Burma, where she was busy with the Lord's work. Ida Scudder, somewhat later, is a medical missionary in India. She didn't go with her husband. She was a single woman. She had a bit of technical expertise. She was a physician. And that's another way that women were involved in missions. A third way is as deaconesses, and that was one of the big fields for deaconesses in the 19th and early 20th century. There had been deaconesses in the early church. And it seems as though initially those deaconesses had a public ministry for the whole church. Gradually that was constrained, so that one of the tasks of the deaconesses was to assist women in baptism. Because of total immersion, it was unseemly for men to assist women. When deaconesses reemerge in the 19th century, their primary role is equivalent to what we would think of today as social work. Do a lot of this sort of social service things. And some identify them almost entirely with nursing. Of course, we should also note the recipients of this missionary work, the little caption here, when our missionary women meet with their brown sisters in India. More often, these women would be called our heathen sisters, which I think is a fascinating turn of phrase, because there's both the sameness and the affinity and the connection of sisterhood, and then this labeling of the difference as heathen. So there was clearly something unlike that was going on there. Really, the effect of Christian missions on women who received the missionaries is minimal in terms of religion. The effect seemed to be usually in other ways. For example, a fascinating statistic to me, the proportion of physicians in India who are women is far higher, at least it was 5 years ago, than the proportion of women who are physicians in the United States. In part, this is the result of the work of women like Ida Scudder. It's also in part a result of the structure of Indian society in which it would be unseemly for a male physician to attend a sick woman. Back in the U.S., of course, women were also involved in missions as patrons, right, as supporters. In the Ladies' Aid, the sewing circle, on a local level. And these women received from that work an expanded view of the world. I think it's very important to realize that they knew about India. They knew about Burma. They knew about China. And they knew a lot about people's lives there because of their support of individual missionaries. They also developed organizations to administer their work. This is Catherine Lehman, who was the executive for the Women's Missionary Federation of the old American Lutheran Church, the American Lutheran Church that was founded in 1930. It provided women with experience in organizational management kinds of skills. And gradually, those women's organizations shift their concerns. I see Sharon looking. These are ELC educational materials. Here you see Mrs. L. M. Ormseth of Havre, Montana, has written a little help about evangelism. And I think she also wrote the one behind Helps for the Ladies' Aid President, which has things like parliamentary procedure. Then you see something up there about the work of the church. So that the women's organizations really, I think, are the origin of adult education in the churches. I'm thoroughly convinced of that. It's the first place that it happens. It's the place where Bible study happens the most consistently. So enough about that. I see I need to be moving along. And consequently, I think it's really important that we don't forget in our pursuit of women's public active leadership, the ordinary ways ordinary, in quotations, that women participate in Christianity. Here you see a woman carrying a child into a church for baptism. Certainly one of the very important things that happens in every congregation. Teaching Sunday school, being involved in confirmation, and particularly in the Lutheran tradition, this is really important. The basic theological education that students, kids, receive in confirmation is crucial, and it was given to boys and girls without discrimination. When I was teaching at Valparaiso, a fascinating little incident happened. Valparaiso University is a school associated loosely with the Missouri Synod, and there was a young Missouri Synod student who came to the altar rail, and there could see as he looked ahead that he was going to be given one of the elements by a woman. And quickly he did in his mind a little theological juggling, and he figured out that it's God who works, not the person. And so even though he had been taught that women weren't supposed to do this, it probably would be okay because it was God who works. Now that's not, of course, what I would hope that would become to be someone's position, but it does emphasize my point about how important that ordinary way of participating in Christianity is, a basic theological education. And things like singing in the choir. This is a woman who painted that altar painting, but the various ways that women have facilitated the multiple aspects of the life of the church. Now, more recently, in the last 150 years, last 100 years, we have seen an expansion of the possibilities of public leadership that women have exercised on behalf of the whole church. First, three early examples of this. Amanda Berry Smith, really a contemporary of Sojourner Truth, who was a preacher and a missionary. She spent time in India as well as Africa, as well as traveling around the United States. The basis for her public preaching was her spiritual gift. Okay, that's one way that women have made this argument. God has given me a gift. The Spirit bloweth where the Spirit willeth, and the church better let it. Right? Another way is by giving women the office of ministry. And here's Antoinette Brown, the first American woman to be fully ordained. It's by one of the Congregationalist groups. Or a third way is, this is Mary Baker Eddy, the founder of the Christian Science, right? You can also found your own church. Amy Semple McPherson would be another example of that. Mainstream Protestantism and Catholicism have had changes since the middle of this century. Here you see, although in full habit, the movement of Roman Catholic sisters into a new range of possibilities, partly because of Vatican II, and a different understanding of the church as the whole people of God, not focusing only on the priesthood. Roman Catholic women are not ordained at this point. One of my teachers, who is a Roman Catholic theologian, I once overheard him being asked at a party when Roman Catholics would ordain women. He said, not this fall. I mean, we don't know when that will happen or if it will. For Protestants, ordination has been achieved. The Anglicans were among the last. Here you see some of the Philadelphia 11, the 11 Episcopal women who were irregularly ordained in, I think, 76. I think that's right. Of course, Lutheran women have been having the opportunity to be ordained since 1970. Last summer, in this very village, I heard the news when April Larson was elected bishop of one of the Wisconsin synods. She's with us starting today for almost 2 weeks. Here is a chart with, if you can't see the bottom, these are statistics from the late 80s about the numbers of women who are ordained in some of the churches of the United States. Lutherans have now moved up, I think, to 10%. I think we're up to 10%. The others, I don't know the current statistics. So I leave you with with this picture as I never know quite what to do with this picture. It's obviously it's very striking. But I put it up there as the image to leave with you as you think about this question of the relationship of feminism and Christianity. Or, which I give you that question instead of what is the role of women? Because I think that's not as productive of a question. What is women's role? Focuses on the wrong question. What can women do? Rather than, well, what are these two things about? Are they about the same thing? What does Christianity offer to women? What has recent women's concerns offered to Christianity? I would argue, as you're not surprised to hear, that there is an affinity between the two, and an affinity that allows for affirmation, but which also requires adjustment. The history that we look at gives us mixed evidence. It gives us, I didn't give you a lot of it, but it gives us evidence for the two being antithetical. That evidence is certainly there. And one way to react to that is to be apathetic.